here's this porn star, and it's like, oh, well, I guess you got over that whole being nude thing.
Radio Drone.
I am Josh Hadley. With me, as always, is the great monkey man from the north, Peter. He's the living embodiment of meh, would be Cecil. If you guys are surfing looking for some of these movies that we're going to be talking about tonight, you need to use a VPN. And that would be where you go to Nord. NordVPN. But you got to go through the link 1201beyond.com/DromeVPN. And that will take you to Nord's site. Well, they will encrypt your data. They will mask you online. You'll be able to use remote locations. So, hey, you want to watch something that's only available in England? Boom. You're now on a server in England. You can watch that thing. But you gotta use the link at 1201beyond.com/DromeVPN. And for only $3.49 a month, that's 75% off of a 3-year plan, you can have Nord's protection. And then also, if you just wanna, you know, go to a website that after you've got Nord, go to adamandeve.com. Use the promo code DROME, D-R-O-M-E, and you will get 50% off of a single item, 3 free DVDs, a free sex swing, and free U.S. shipping, all for using the promo code DROME at adamandeve.com. All that crap out of the way, let's talk about horror films of the 80s. Peter wasn't here for the first half, but Cecil and I talked about 80 through 84, so 1985 was literally that middle year. Because you had horror films, you had the slasher boom was kind of rolling down at this point, you had horror films entering the real mainstream, I mean, up to this point, you didn't have major studios putting millions, you know, tens and twenties of millions of dollars behind horror films as often. I mean, obviously you always had this, they were always making horror films. When it comes to 1985, what horror film jumps out at you?
This is a hell of a year. I mean, this is kind of a banner year for horror films. You have a lot of stuff that's released that would become classics. I mean, this is the year, the first night on Elm Street, Return of the Living Dead, Day of the Dead, which in my opinion is Romero's best zombie movie. But I'd like to spotlight, and technically it came out in 84 in the UK, but in 85 in the States, was Ghoulies.
Well, I do want to correct you. Nightmare on Elm Street was 1984.
Was it
Nightmare on Elm Street 2 was really 1985.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
Also going to do a similar thing because, you know, with Return of the Living Dead and Reanimator and the stuff, so many great movies. But I am going to talk about a very obscure one, a little film called Rocktober Blood. Fantastic soundtrack. Just a neat little movie that unfortunately did recently get a Blu-ray release, but The guys that did it were kind of shysters, vested into it with the crowdfunding, and really, really sucks. Because it's a movie that deserves better, but unfortunately, now it's aligned with it. But it's a really neat little horror film.
See, I'm actually torn between two different movies that would be my pick for 85. One, Life Force, because Matilda May running around as a naked space vampire rampaging through London. Yeah. I'm actually gonna go out of the country. Demons. Demons is an amazing movie. I think it might be the most beautiful looking movie of 1985.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of influence. He didn't direct it, but, you know, Argento was a producer
also,
on it.
You know, it's Lamberto Bava directed, so it's like, you've got a guy, you know, the son of Mario Bava, who really knows his shit, and you've got Argento in there producing it, and obviously had some hand, I think, in the aesthetics, at least in, like, kind of teaching Lamberto some of the ropes and stuff. Demons is absolutely a great-looking movie for many reasons. That, like, look who's attached to it.
But I also want to say, like, look at Phenomena, or as we got it in America, Creepers. That's the Argento movie of this year. That movie is so beautifully lit, as any Argento movie is. It's basically Total Eclipse of the Heart as a horror movie. And, no, am I wrong? It really...
No, it's a beautiful looking movie.
It's totally clear. It's a Bonnie Tyler music video as a horror film. And I don't mean that as an insult to Bonnie Tyler or Phenomena.
It's also one of Jennifer Connelly's first movies. We also had one of Jim Carrey's first movies this year with Once Bitten.
That movie, I still think, is not only hilarious, but I think is more prescient now than it was then.
When he's at the drive-in and everyone is having sex... And, like, all the cars are rocking, and he's...
Best part is, because in a PG at that time, you got to say f**k once. They used their f**k brilliantly in that film, in what is the funniest scene in the movie.
Mark doesn't want you, because you're mean and evil. He wants me, because I'm nice and sweet and pure. So fuck off!
And also, I like the meta nature of it. They're chasing them all around, and all of a sudden, Lauren Hutton's like, can you at least try the doorknob first? I have to replace every one of these doors tomorrow! And then they open... I'm like, okay, that was really funny.
Yeah, it's got a lot of funny moments. There was an interview after, I think, Dumb and Dumber came out, where Jim Carrey was talking about Once Bitten, and he was saying how he wanted to play it more wacky, and there's really only one moment in the film you kind of see Jim Carrey doing his shtick. And as much as I like Jim Carrey when he's doing, like, Ace Ventura and all that, it wouldn't have worked him being the Ace movie.
Yeah.
So he was talking about how, you know, they didn't allow him to be brilliant. In this case, it's not that kind of movie. You being like that, it wouldn't have worked. The movie works
yeah,
with him.
Yeah, I feel like
kind
what
of being
he, what
the
he
loser,
did for the movie
you know?
Really worked for it.
Thing with Once Bitten, we could do a whole show on the train wreck that was behind the scenes. Once Bitten, everybody hated it. The producers hated the film. Jim Carrey hated the film. The director hated the film. The film ruined the screenwriter's career. He literally had to go back to working at a video store, and he said the most humiliating moment he's ever suffered is when someone came back to return that movie on VHS and said, this is the worst piece of shit I've ever seen, and whoever wrote it should never be allowed to make a movie again. And his manager pointed out, the guy vacuuming the carpet over there, he wrote it.
God, how do you not hang yourself?
Other than Once Bitten, we've also got stuff like, we've got Silver Bullet, maybe one of the dumbest Stephen King adaptations of the 80s, and that's saying something.
Hey, but great performances from Corey Haim and one of my favorite Gary Busey characters. He's so fun and charismatic in that movie.
I actually don't even think Gary Busey was acting. I think they just gave him a pint of bourbon and just let him go.
That movie has one of my favorite werewolf transformations, though. Like, I love it when the eyeless priest or whatever starts, like, transforming in that tunnel or whatever it is, and then he just beats the cop to death with the club or the baseball bat. Like, that's a great creepy scene. Like, really, really well lit. Very, there's some nice, like, even if it is kind of a dumb movie about, like, the silver half bicycle, half motorcycle thing, like, it's got some really cool, werewolf moments in it, and some genuinely creepy moments in my opinion. I think Silver Bullet's pretty underrated.
Well, we also had for Stephen King Cat's Eye, where, well, one of the segments works. I mean, it's an anthology, and one of them works.
I like all of them.
I did not.
You like, what, Quitters Inc.?
Yeah.
I don't know. I like all of them. They're all enjoyable in their own way. They're all very distinctly French, which is interesting, because a lot of anthologies, they kind of have a similar vibe, but this, like, varies dramatically. The smoking company that will, like, every time you get caught, or you're trying to quit smoking, every time you get caught trying to smoke, they do something horrible to you.
It's run by the mob!
It's run by the mob, you know? Up to and including, they rape his wife because he got caught smoking, and then it ends... The thing where the guy has to climb around the outside of the building, and then it goes to the girl fighting off the little goblin who's trying to steal her soul. It's really, it varies wildly, but I've always had a soft spot for it.
I feel like it does what an anthology movie is supposed to do. I like that the stories are like vastly different, that it's like a different vibe for each one. It's why I really like the one, I think it's called Body Bags. Like, every story in that one is completely different.
Body Bags wasn't meant to be a movie. I talk about...
It's going to be a show.
Yeah, I talk about this in my book. That was supposed to be Showtime's answer to Tales from the Crypt. And
yeah.
When it didn't work, they just threw all the segments together and said, hey, look, now it's a movie.
I'm glad they salvaged it to some extent, because there's some nice little features in there.
was it Stacy Keach with the living hair?
Yes.
Yes.
It was actually Aliens. Excellent. That was Aliens as his hair.
I love that one.
But then this year also brought us kind of more artsy fare that didn't work, like The Bride, Frank Rodham's movie with Sting and Jennifer Beals, where I think they made the wrong movie with this one. All the stuff with Dr. Frankenstein and his bride and all that was boring as hell. Clancy Brown as the monster, and then you've got Igor and their friendship. That's the interesting stuff in the movie. I didn't care about Sting and Jennifer Beals. I wanted Clancy Brown's plotline. You guys made the wrong movie.
Not in a long time.
I don't know. I don't think I have, but I would like to watch, Clancy Brown as the monster.
You know, we have, William Malone's Creature. The, hey, totally not Alien movie, but I happen to dig Creature, maybe because I know William Malone, but I've always kind of liked the movie. It's got a lot of problems. I'm not going to say it doesn't, but Return of the Living Dead's out this year. Yeah, well, so is Day of the Dead, and this one's so nihilistically dark, you were getting no comedy out of this.
Joe Pilato, just like scene-stealing performances every time he shows up. Like, it's why it's my favorite. I love him so much as Captain Rhodes.
I actually like Lori Cardell.
Well, everyone's great.
I think she...
Everybody plays off each other really, really well.
Absolutely was not, like, people just didn't get it at the time. And it has since gone on to be very, very beloved. Like, Return of the Living Dead was so good because it was funny, but it was also scary and had some amazing visuals. But Day, it was just so depressing. Mm. And I think people really weren't prepared for that. It was here's like the end of the zombie war.
It was nihilistic.
Yeah. And
Nobody was really like good or bad in that movie. Like, both the scientists and the soldiers had like major morality problems.
Yeah, but I mean, if you think about it, who is going to be the ones that survive? Ones that are the most cutthroat.
And I stand by Romero on this because of how screwed the system was. It was uncut, which meant it only made in like 10% of the theaters it would have if he'd cut it to R. So it made no money.
That's what bothers me about the rating system. As long as you're if you're making a film, as long as you're not making hardcore pornography, there's no reason why it shouldn't be able to play in a regular theater. I think it's ridiculous. As adults, you have other adults telling you that you're not adult enough to watch this.
I think a highly underrated Friday the 13th film, I think A New Beginning, is a lot...
Part 5 is awesome.
Because people immediately dismiss it. That's the one without Jason. Yeah, but it's actually a pretty decent film on its own.
Good. It's got some of the best, side characters. It's got a great performance. What's the dude that plays...
John Shepard. What's his name?
He's so good. He's so good at playing, like, a traumatized Tommy Jarvis. Like, a very realistic version of him. Of what he would be after he suffered the events of the fourth film. Like a natural progression of what he would be like in this halfway house. I love the idea that it goes back to what the first film was, which was like a whodunit kind of thing. You don't know who the killer is, even though they do kind of sloppily reveal it by accident by playing the spooky Sting music. Just the guy that ends up being the killer makes an evil face. The part 5 is awesome. Great music, great direction. Same guy that directed Savage. It's got more of a sleazy feel to it than a lot of the other Friday the 13ths do. Like, there's some nice, like, neon lighting in there, here and there. It's great characters, like, decent, inventive kills. Overall, I think part 5 is one of the most, underrated of the franchise, and in my opinion, one of the best sequels, one of the best movies in the whole franchise overall, I would say.
See, I know why you like it. Those goddamn enchiladas!
Ooh, baby! Hey, baby!
I think it has some of the best kills, really entertaining, and I don't think it deserves a fraction, any of the hatred, really. In a way, Halloween 3 of the Friday the 13th series, you know, because
pretty
it's
much,
not Jason, then... But really, it is... Like, you don't really know that it's not Jason until the end of the film anyway. I don't know. It was kind of a neat departure, and it was a way for them to do it without Jason, but to keep it going until they figured out, all right, well, we got to bring the character back. Let's resurrect him from the dead and just go balls out. So,
yeah, they found a really great way of incorporating Jason in that movie as more of like a trauma of like a PTSD kind of thing from Tommy. Like, Jason may be dead, but he never left his mind. Like, he's having hallucinations, he's seeing him in the mirror, he's seeing him outside, like, he's still haunting him even though he's dead, which is a great touch. I thought that was awesome.
Well, 1985 also brought us Fright Night, which we've talked about in a previous episode, where I'm just not a big fan of the first movie. I understand why people like it, but I like the second film way more than I like the first one. So Fright Night to me is just, eh.
They even, although it, the thing that always gets me about Fright Night is I had seen Fright Night after years of Married with Children. So I'm watching it and I'm like, why are they trying to make Marcy Darcy sexy?
It's not that she's a lesbian in real life. I've never thought she was even remotely attractive as an actress.
Yeah, like, I have no issue with her. She's really funny. And I think that on Married with Children, her and Al going back and forth it was hilarious. I never found her attractive either, but she always had a very, even though she is gay, but she has a motherly neighbor Gladys Kravitz sort of thing going on, which is really, I think just shows how strongly I associated her with her character. It was just funny to me, like I'm watching it and I'm like, it was like watching like an ant try to be sexy.
when you play type for so long, it was kind of the same thing with Bryan Cranston when he started doing Breaking Bad. Like, he was still kind of the dad from Malcolm in the Middle. So it's like, it took a little while to warm up to him, at least for people who, because he had always kind of done comedy. So it's like, now he's like this serious actor. So that's what playing type can do to you if you do it for so long.
I had sort of the same problem with Married with Children. When you watch, like, on Miami Vice or on an old Hunter episode where Ed O'Neill is like a super corrupt FBI agent and he's a killer.
Oh my god.
And
yeah.
I'm just like, well, but that's Al Bundy, episodes. You know?
He's the one that goes like kind of off the grid and become, he's like deep undercover as like a
But it's just like, hey,
whatever,
that's Al Bundy, becomes, you know?
That's an awesome episode. He's a great actor, man. Even those like, short, brief segments that he has in Wayne's World, where he's just like ranting about the system and about murdering a man and tearing a man's heart out. Like,
passion.
That's so good. I think Ed O'Neill is quite underrated as an actor. I really like him.
And he sang Booty Time.
But then 1985 also brought us Ghoulies, as we discussed, which I think is a great movie. Ghoulies
is just awesome.
Ghoulies was the surprise success of the year. That film, on its own, kept Empire Pictures alive for another 2 years.
When it comes to like the little rubber monster movies, like I love it so much. I remember discovering, it was the second one I saw first, because I remember the guy getting in the trailer that gets bit in the ass or bit by I don't know where the ghoulie bites him. It could be anywhere from Ghoulies 2, and then the first one some years after that. And it's just, it's so much fun. You've got like occult stuff. You've got the spooky house, you've got the rubber monsters, you've got like midgets in robes, like it's Joe Bob would call it, midget foo. It's just an awesome movie. I've always loved Ghoulies. And Ghoulies 2 gave us a fantastic track from Wasp.
Well, Ghoulies, Charles Band credits the complete success of the movie to the poster, which he was initially against, that one with the ghoulie in the toilet, and then the tagline,
yes.
Awesome. They'll get you in the end, haha. Because, well, first of all, he was shown that poster, and there was not a scene like that in the movie. So they had to go and reshoot the part and add that scene. He thinks, without that poster, that movie would not have been the success that it was, that poster made Ghoulies.
I think he may be right about that, because that's a really iconic poster.
It is. And they recently put out on, I don't know if it's still on the Full Moon site, but you can buy a little resin toilet with the ghoulie.
I have that. Charles Band sent me one of those. I have that sitting on my desk.
Oh yeah?
That's my toilet ghoulie.
I do think that's largely why the film was a success. Just as ridiculous as it is, like that's when you think Ghoulies, you think of the ghoulie popping out of the toilet.
Yeah.
But then when you think of Hills Have Eyes, what do you think of? You think of it being a movie where a dog has a flashback to a previous movie. I'm not lying. Hills Have Eyes 2 doesn't even really count as a movie to me, because it's only half a film. But then there was also, and we did a whole retrospective, so we'll gloss over, Howling 2, Your Sister is a Werewolf, Christopher Lee and Reb Brown, come on, Christopher Lee trying to go undercover in a punk club, what else do you need? Yes, and the hair, he's got his hair all done up.
Oh my god. And just Reb Brown, coated in denim, screaming at everything. Just, what a movie. What an acid trip of a film.
Then there was Nightmare on Elm Street 2, which I think is a movie I love and I hate. It is an absolutely pathetically bad Nightmare on Elm Street movie, but on its own, but on its own, I really like. Well, because it's not a Nightmare on Elm Street movie.
Nah, I don't agree. I think it's a solid, still a solid Freddy movie. And Mark Patton, just similar to John Shepard in Part 5, is awesome. Like, what a great survivor character in that one. It's because he's not only a guy that's getting like stalked by the killer or whatever and going through problems in that regard. Like, he's also, you know, suffering growing pains. He's going through transitions in his life, and he's suffering, like, insecurities and trying to get along with people at school and stuff like that. Like, it's both an 80s slasher film and a coming-of-age story. Like, I think that's why it's one of the most solid ones, in my opinion, in the series. I've always loved, I've loved 2 a lot. I love the makeup on, I think, 2 as my favorite Freddy Krueger, and wet and syrupy he looks all the time, and just some of the effects are brilliant, like when he rips his way through Jesse, just comes out of his torso is just awesome. Some of the best horror effects, and just all awesome Krueger lines as well. You are all my children now. Like, that's awesome. That's as Freddy Krueger as it gets.
But then 1985 also brought us Reanimator, which we literally just talked about a few weeks ago, so we'll gloss
Fantastic.
Over. You know, we've got Return of the Living Dead, which if it's between Return and Day for 85, well, I think Day is the more well-made movie with more to say. I like Return better, though.
Return is so entertaining. And there's quite a rich history of rights struggles that goes along with Return of the Living Dead. Because when Night of the Living Dead came out, Romero and, forget who the other guy was, but they were
Russo.
In, like, rights issues of who gets to keep this name, that name, one guy got to keep, Living, I think, was like, Living Dead was like the term he could use, but like, Romero couldn't, which is why the sequel was Dawn of the Dead and not Dawn of the Living Dead.
I love Day of the Dead, but Dawn of the Living Dead is just so much more of a crowd pleaser. Trash being, having two of the most memorable scenes in horror history. The
dancing
first thing was
naked in a graveyard.
Yes. Just the zombies look phenomenal. The fact that they're like the fast zombies after we'd been the slow moving zombies. It was just kind of a different take on the whole thing. Some just brilliant visuals. It's really just an awesome film. It's
such
funny.
A punk rock movie. It's that's such a punk vibe to it.
Yeah, and what's crazy was for years they had lost the music rights to a bunch of the songs.
Mm.
So they had to use, like, you know, placeholders. And finally they were able to get
nope,
the rights
nope.
issues worked out. There's
one song.
Still?
The Damned's Deadbeat Dance is still not on the DVD versions. There's still one song missing.
Oh.
When we first get introduced to Suicide, when he's driving the car and he's like, you know, you got money for gas? That's a different song. You have to go to the VHS to get the original.
Oh.
There's still one missing song.
Well, at least they got most of them, but still it sucks. Like, that's something I really hope that they have figured out moving forward to put clauses in. Like, I understand if the movie goes to a new, if it goes from Blu-ray to whatever is going to the next thing after that or whatever, that there's some sort of thing in there that makes sure that the original people still get paid, but that it doesn't, you know, screw them over and then they don't have to take the songs out. Because how many products have we lost because they've had to remove the music from them? And in certain instances, like with the Werewolf TV series, there's one song playing during a very, very, very essential moment in the series. And that's what's holding it back, because the people that own the rights, they will not allow it. That's so annoying.
Cyndi Lauper is who you're talking about.
Is it Cyndi Lauper?
It is Cyndi Lauper. It's in the nightclub scene.
Oh.
Because Cyndi Lauper also would not let them reuse her music for Miami Vice. There are 3 songs. The Miami Vice, the complete series set, there are 3 songs they couldn't relicense. 2 of them are Cyndi Lauper songs, and they have sound-alikes that are actually so close. If I didn't tell you they were sound-alikes, you wouldn't know it.
You see, Cyndi Lauper, this is why Roddy Piper hit you with a framed painting, okay?
This is why you're doing, the proactive commercials now.
So then we move on to 1986. 1986 was a banner year. I'm just looking at this list going, damn, that was some good stuff. Well, first of all, do we even need to talk about how great Aliens is? Because Aliens was sort of the best film of the year. I don't think there's any debate over that. There's not going to be a better horror film in 1986. I don't care what anybody
and
says.
And it's one of the best Vietnam War movies ever, too. Because the whole thing is like an analogy of the Vietnam War.
I actually just watched Aliens again this past week for a video that I'm currently working on, and it holds up in every possible way. It's just a phenomenal film. I mean, I watched, I hadn't seen it in a while, the director's cut that put in all the missing bits. The butter, the hallway scene with the guns, like all that stuff that got cut for the theatrical. And man, just what a powerhouse film. I mean, it's got everything you could possibly want in a science fiction film. You know, emotion and action and amazing effects and, it's just some incredible cast. Just what a brilliant movie.
Speaking of a brilliant movie, now you gotta remember the slasher films as we know them are starting to wind down at this point. The slasher boom is over. You've still got the franchises. You still got a Friday the 13th, the Nightmare on Elm Street, stuff like that. You've got Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 coming out. So you still have the big ones. In general, the slasher boom is winding down. And you know, when any kind of boom starts coming to an end or starts overstaying its welcome, you get the, this isn't even a parody, but you get the satires. And I think April Fool's Day is one of the best slasher movie satires out there, because the first time you see it, you do not see that ending coming, and you think it just-
I hate that ending. I hate that movie so much.
I love this! Come on, Peter!
Because even the title, then, it all kind of comes full circle. I was watching it with my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, but she had never even heard of it before. So we start watching it. 10 minutes into the film, she sees Muffy, and she's like, wait, who is that? I recognize her. And she grabs her phone and goes to look it up on the IMDb, and I grabbed it out of her hand because I was like, if she sees Muffy / Buffy, it's going to ruin the whole movie. So I was like, no, you can't. She's like, what? What are you doing? And I'm like, you can't look.
Just watch the movie. It's Deborah Foreman. It's Deborah Foreman, okay?
Yes.
But I like April Fool's Day. Peter doesn't. I still think it was one of the smarter slasher movies out there. Because it's technically not even a slasher movie once you know the ending.
Like,
you don't actually see any of the kills, which at first you think, oh, this is cheap. The MPAA got a hold of this. You know, all the kills happen off screen. And then at the end you go, oh, I see why.
I see why, because this movie sucks.
Well, and then there was also Jim Wynorski's Chopping Mall, which I just showed my girlfriend a few weeks ago.
Now, that one is awesome.
No, it's a dumb movie.
These people are dumb.
Well, it's a Roger Corman movie.
Well, yeah,
so.
Of course, about robots in a shopping mall blowing up Barbara Crampton's head.
Kelly Maroney is working at the pizza place, and she drops the pizza, and corn goes everywhere. Like,
what pizza place is wall Roger Corman movie posters?
Oh, just right.
Okay.
Oh, it's such a fun, just awesome movie, though.
But we are going to talk about Trauma, Class of Nukem High.
Oh, yes.
Now, I have seen the newer ones that they made like a few years ago, but I recently watched 1, 2, and 3 all back to back. 3 is garbage. I thought 2 was shockingly better than I remembered it being. But
3 was kind of a mess. Like, it sort of felt like they pieced it together from unused footage or something. Like, it felt kind of off.
Yeah, but Class of Nukem High, the first one, I love it. It's a trauma movie that, even though Toxie doesn't appear in it, it really feels like it takes place in the Toxic Avenger universe.
Oh yeah, it's total slime globola kind of stuff. It's great.
No, I want to gloss over Critters because I would like to do a full Critters retrospective, but I liked Critters in 86. I thought that was a great movie, so I want to gloss over that because I would like to do a full retro. But then there's dumb shit. Like, we talked about it in our Wes Craven retrospective. Deadly Friend is just a bad movie.
I love that movie. It's great.
Of course you do. But then this year also brought us Demons 2, which I don't enjoy as much as Demons. I'll admit that.
It's still fun.
But I like Demons 2, but Demons 2 is a weird sequel in that it's a sequel that's not a sequel. They watch the first movie on television. So it's not a sequel, but the first movie's a movie? What the hell are you doing, Bava?
It's like they made a movie about the events of the first film because it happened, and it's like there's this, I don't know, like the demons are like, I don't know, they like quarantine them or something, and then they come back. Like, it's a really weird meta sequel.
It's sort of like how in Silent Night, Deadly Night 3, which is a direct sequel to 2, which is a direct sequel to 1, she watches the first movie on television.
wait a second. The first movie,
the original.
The
yeah, and you're like, okay, wait a second.
What?
But then this year also brought us Evil Laugh, which reason anyone will ever seek out this horribly bad movie. Kimmy McCammy is in it. Who is Kimmy McCammy?
Kimmy McCammy?
Yeah. Huge future porn star Ashlyn Gere in one of her horror roles. Okay, here's the weird thing. She's one of the few porn actresses that could actually act, but not yet. Cause she is awful in Evil Laugh. She couldn't act yet.
Dakota was talking about Kimmy McCammy in Creepazoids, where she was supposed to do a nude scene, but she, like, was really uncomfortable and didn't want to do it, and then,
Linnea Quigley got it.
Linnea Quigley was like, I'll do it! Because Linnea Quigley has no problem, you know, being nude. So she ended up doing, and he's like, years later, here's this porn star, and it's like, oh, well, I guess she got over that whole being nude thing.
we're all gonna clash. I totally get why people like Cronenberg's The Fly. I do not. I never liked it. I don't like this movie. I find it boring. I find it tedious. I do not like this movie.
Oh my God, what's wrong with you?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't like it.
Objectively great film. You just don't like it not to like it. It's just, you're just like, everybody loves it, so I've gotta hate it. Crucify him.
Yes, because that's the way I was in 1986 when I saw it in the theater and didn't like it then.
Boo.
Die.
This year also has the best Friday the 13th movie, Jason Lives.
Oh, yeah.
Without a doubt, it's the best film in the entire franchise, because I think it took Tom McLaughlin, and again, we're gonna go with this April Fool's Day kind of thing, he didn't make a straight Friday the 13th movie. He injected not only a lot of humor, but satirical elements of the franchise up to this point. And I don't know why, but that works so well for it.
It kind of had like a tongue-in-cheek quality to it, which none of the sequels really had yet. Like there were humorous elements to them, but this one was kind of like, there's some things that they're kind of poking fun at, but they're doing it in a loving way. It's still got a great Jason in it. CJ Graham did a wonderful job. Tom Matthews was awesome as Tommy Jarvis, even though they kind of forgot the whole PTSD thing from part 5, but he's still really good as the heroic leading man type. I've always very much enjoyed part 6. Great soundtrack too. Some awesome tracks from Alice Cooper.
Lots of fun, lots of blood. A really entertaining entry.
And there was a moment where, because they had gotten CJ Graham later on, he was working at like a bar and he was doing a thing where he shows up dressed as Jason. It was like a Halloween event or something. And they decided to go with him for the role, and they had already shot footage, I think it's with the paintballers, of a different guy playing Jason. And he's a rather portly fellow. Definitely does not have, you can definitely notice it if you watch for it. If you've never noticed that, it is a different, much fatter Jason in the paintball scene compared to the other scenes where you have Jason played by CJ Graham who is quite a strapping stud. He's probably a lot of people talk about how Jack, like, Kane Hodder is. Like, CJ Graham was a fucking muscle mountain. Like, this is one of the most intimidating Jasons of the entire franchise.
But then this year also brought us From Beyond, which again we talked about in our
awesome
Lovecraft retrospective. We've got the boring art film Gothic, of course, British. There is what might be the most disturbing horror film ever made, Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
No, technically, this is cheating to put this in 1986, because that's when it came out in art houses.
Yeah.
It did not get anything outside of a token release until 1988.
Well, it took a while, yeah.
So most of us didn't see this till the later 80s, but technically it's a 1986 film. My God, I mean, this movie, you feel like you need to shower after watching it. Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer is not a fun horror movie. Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer is a documentary about a fictional person, kind of based on Henry Lee Lucas, but kind of not.
It is a very uncomfortable film. It is a great film, one of those ones kind of like Martyrs. You really, you don't want to watch it very much. great performances. It's just a very unpleasant film, but it's a great film. It's so hard to kind of put that into the thing. It's like, yeah, this is a movie that you should see. Just know that it's going to ruin your day.
You have to be in a certain mood to watch it. You have to know that you're going into a very nihilistic, just greasy, depressing world that the character of Henry lives in and the people that he associates with. Like, this is a guy that just no real motive, just enjoys killing people in different ways so he doesn't get caught. Just incredibly disturbing. Amazing performance from Michael Rooker. And if he was like a delivery man.
There's a couple of different stories about how he got the job. John McNaughton said at one point, yeah, he was looking for who he was going to play Henry, and he had the script from the writer, FedExed or whatever, over to him, and Rooker was the delivery guy, and you know, he opened
that's
the door and
he
just
too.
Said, oh God, please tell me you can act.
Yeah, that's the one I've heard. I don't know if that's true. Like, I kind of hope it is, because that's great.
Sounds like it'd be a
in
great
recent
story,
years, you know. Michael Rooker has told a completely different story about how he got the script from his agent and all this. So I don't know what the true story is, but
he was like, it was like a theater house kind
yeah.
of actor. Like,
so
he was acting.
So I don't know if it's John McNaughton was just taking the piss out of the story, or you know, so that's just there are multiple stories about how he got hired on this. I do not like this movie. I did not like the sequel. I did not like the remake. The Hitcher has.
You do not like green eggs and ham.
The Hitcher has never worked for me. Rutger Hauer is good in it. I don't like the movie.
That's awesome. I love The Hitcher.
Yeah, same.
Of course you do. Now, the next couple, I wanna, it's weird how many movies in 1986 we've done in various retrospectives. House came out this year. We did a full retrospective. Let's breeze over that. Invaders
Excellent
from Mars
film.
Came out this year. We did a retrospective on the canon films of Toby Hooper. Let's gloss over
yep.
that. Poltergeist 2 came out this year. It's garbage, but we did a full retrospective. Let's gloss over that. Psycho 3 came out this year. Way better than it has a right to be, but we did a full retrospective. Let's
really
gloss
underrated.
Over that. Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 came out this year. We've done technically two, because we did it as a Texas Chainsaw retrospective and as the canon films of Toby Hooper retrospective. So let's gloss over that. So let's talk about the movies of 1986 we haven't done in retrospectives. I know Cecil likes the movie. I do not. Killer Workout.
Oh,
I'm sorry,
excellent.
David A. Pryor sucks
no,
as a director.
Doesn't.
Oh,
awesome.
Shut your mouth, dude. Come on. It's so good. Like, I love the David A. Pryor stuff. How can you, like, friggin' Deadly Prey and the Killer Workout. Ugh. They're just
Final
really...
Sanction is one of the best
yes.
ones. Robert Zadar versus Deadly Prey.
Right. They're just these small, entertaining films. You know, that's action, horror, whatever he decides to cover. Usually action or horror. But sometimes action and horror. They're fun. Like, I'm not looking for high art. I'm looking for women in spandex and a mysterious killer.
Killer Workout teaches you the valuable lesson of never get into a fist fight unless you're fresh from a workout. Because if you notice, the people who win fights in this movie, they put in a solid bench session first.
Well, and then there's Maximum Overdrive, which we covered in our Stephen King retrospective.
Yep.
There's Little Shop of Horrors. I mean, I guess technically it's a horror film. I mean, it even has horror in the title.
Well, it's satire, I guess. It's kind of tongue-in-cheek.
I really dig the remake. This is one of those few times where I like the remake better than the original.
Is this Little the one with Rick Moranis?
Yeah. The Rick Moranis remake is just phenomenal. The original, I think it has its charm, but yeah, the remake, I think, hit all the right notes with it.
Steve Martin as the dentist to me is the scene stealing character. That's just
no.
So funny to see him play a character like that.
No, right. Bill Murray as the psycho dental patient that was played by Jack Nicholson in the original. That's the scene stealer, is Bill Murray. I just wish the original, you know, the original Godzilla ending had been left in the movie, because I love the original ending. I even love the music in it. I don't know why they cut that. But
you know what? I gotta go with them on this. I like, cause I didn't see it until they released it on DVD, you know, years and years later. The movie is dark. The having it end with Audrey basically eating everything and becoming, you know, huge. And I don't know. It would have worked better as like a dream sequence or something. But I kind of liked it that they didn't end it on it being a completely depressing ending where they eat everybody. You know, they eat Audrey, they eat Rick Moranis. It felt like a betrayal, you know?
You're just a pussy.
I'd rather, this is a case of where I actually was happy with the happy ending.
You need a happy ending.
Right.
Not everything needs to be depressing and dark all the time.
You want happy ending?
not that kind of happy ending.
But then this year also brought us, which again we talked about in our werewolf retro, Monster Dog, where Alice Cooper and Claudio Fragasso were trying to make a bad movie. Neon Maniacs, the movie that asked the question, and I know the behind the scenes, Cecil, but asked the question, what happens if we just don't care?
Well, I wouldn't say they didn't care.
Villains that you stop with fucking water.
I think that it was like, there was more there that they couldn't do. They had some amazing monster designs.
Yeah, they look great.
And that's one I need to dig into that one a little bit more. I know I did a video on it, but I want to know more. I want to know, like, what the hell happened. I believe the story that I've gotten was just that they ran out of money and they could not shoot the ending proper, which is why the film just kind of ends abruptly. I need to know, okay, fine, then what was the original ending going to be?
But then there is Night of the Creeps. We're talking about alternate endings. I like the ending that wasn't on the theatrical prints better. I like the TV ending better, where the aliens come back looking for the thing, and Tom Atkins is, I mean, he's dead, but he's kind of zombieing into the cemetery. I don't like the dog shooting into Muffy's mouth ending. I don't know, I mean, even Fred Decker didn't like that ending. That was the, no, we need a jump scare for the end from the studio.
The only one I've seen is the version with Tom Atkins walking into the graveyard with the aliens coming back. I haven't seen any other version of the film.
That is the TV ending. That's the original ending, but they shot a version where the dog that missing earlier has one in its mouth, and they, you know, after everything, the house is burning down, she picks up the dog, and then it shoots a slug right into her mouth, and then smash cut to credits.
Okay.
That's the theatrical ending. Fred Decker shot that ending in protest, and I agree, that ending doesn't work as well.
The only thing that's a bummer is, I like the original ending where, you know, they're all headed into the graveyard, but it just sucks because it's like, well, I don't want Tom Atkins to be dead. Like, he's awesome. Like,
well, he's dead in both versions, but he's different kinds of dead.
But I mean, it's different kinds of dead. Like, he kind of goes out a hero, the one, and in that he kind of goes out where he's been taken over by the zombie slugs.
This year also brought us Clive Barker's Rawhead Rex, the movie with the googly-eyed demon that Clive Barker tried to have his name taken off of, as he should have. Great story. Wow, does the movie not work, at all.
I really don't like the way the monster looks. He looks like a like a Power Rangers villain. I really don't like it just for the simple reason that they tried to make him look, like, too hardcore. Like, he just looks like a villain that would be on Power Rangers that they'd be fighting that has, like, a heavy metal headbanger theme to him.
Kind of sad that the weakest point is the monster.
Yeah.
Like, I think it worked. Like, if they had been able to make it look good, or maybe gone the Jaws route and didn't show it that much, it probably would have worked a lot better. But because you see it and it looks so silly,
it's so goofy.
It's still, like, I enjoy it, but it's still, like, you recognize that, yeah, this is silly. Like, I'm not afraid of this at all. It's just goofy.
But then there's also Slaughter High, the most British film that's trying to be American that I think I've ever seen. This film is British through and through, clearly shot in England with British actors, yet they keep insisting it takes place in America. And it's that sort of Canadian syndrome of, no, we can't let people know it's in Canada. I'm sorry, Slaughter High is one of the most British American films I've ever seen.
If the movie, it's just funny, oh, we have to, like, it's one thing if they're going out of their way to make some place look like someplace else. But when they're hiding, like, where it was shot, it's like, just, who cares? Like,
just,
I think
have
you're
it
taking
take place wherever.
Yeah, you're putting too much stock in
it. It even uses, you know, April Fool's rules from England. Well, we can just survive until noon, then April Fool's is over. You realize that's only a British tradition, not the American tradition, right? But then there's also Spookies. We could do a whole episode on just what a disaster that was. The only reason to watch Spookies is for the cool special effects scenes, because Spookies is three movies all in one, and I mean that literally. Yeah. It's three different movies edited together to attempt to form one movie. I mean, hell, even the film stocks are different, Cecil.
Well, no, I said kinda. I didn't, it kinda works. Like, I mean, it's still, it's amazing that they were able to make it, like, even work, like, a little bit, but I think it's a bizarre film that, I don't know, I think it works, but it is hard to really wrap your brain around because, yeah, it is three movies, three partially made movies that they merged into one movie to try to salvage something out of it.
Then there is Terror Vision, which I think is a shockingly underrated movie. Terror Vision is so much fun. If you have not seen Ted Nicolau's Terror Vision, you have to. It's like a living cartoon, and I mean that, and that's what it was intended at, with the garish colors, the over-the-top characters.
Yeah.
Even the fact that this is a movie about swingers and gore and boobs, and no one swears, and there's no nudity in it, and there's all the violence, people bleed green. This is literally the closest I think we got around this time to a live-action cartoon.
I love Terror Vision. I just did a video on it, 2 months ago? It's fantastic. It's ridiculous. It's everything kind of amped up to 11. The various cliches of characters, the punk rock daughter, the heavy metal boyfriend, the swinger parents, Vietnam vet grandfather, or I'm sorry, or not the Vietnam vet, the World War II vet grandfather, latchkey kid.
Yeah, that also has basically Elvira crossed with Medusa for the horror host.
Really a ridiculous movie that's just lovable and great soundtrack. From a Fibonacci's.
Fibonacci's, I thought.
Fibonacci's, yeah. Really, really good stuff. I've always had a soft spot for Terror Vision.
Then there is Charles Martin Smith's Trick or Treat, which might be one of the best worst Halloween movies ever. I mean, you got Ozzy Osbourne as a preacher preaching against the evils of heavy metal. That alone is worth it.
What's the name of, like, the rocker dude that the kid, like, worships?
Semi-Kerr.
Semi-Kerr, yeah.
He was originally Blackie Lawless of Wasp was approached to play that role, but he turned it down.
The guy that played it was a solid gold dancer.
Oh.
Well, you could tell when they're doing the segments that he's spinning and dancing and all that crap.
But then there is Troll, the first Troll movie, which, okay, I know Troll's not even a real franchise, but...
It's the first Harry Potter film.
More or less, but then I want to...
His name is literally Harry Potter.
Before we go tonight, I want to talk about Vamp. It's an amazing movie nobody seems to have seen. I think Vamp is so amazing. First of all, Dee Dee Pfeiffer might be the cutest she's ever been in Vamp. It is such an underrated weirdo vampire satire comedy, but played 100% straight. You need to see Vamp. And Grace Jones, the stories are she was beyond difficult on the set, not showing up high, not wanting to do her lines. I'd like to do it in this way. Apparently Grace Jones was a complete prima donna on set, but on camera, she is fucking chilling in this. Mm.
Oh yeah, oh, I love,
yeah. Vamp's great, and the death sequence of Grace Jones is insane.
You know, usually when somebody becomes a much larger star, they poo poo all of their early horror movies. Dee Dee Pfeiffer loves this movie, and she says right on camera, "This might be the favorite role she's ever had."
Oh wow!
And I like the fact that Dee Dee's like, "No, I made Vamp." And then there is Witchboard, which I want to do a full retrospective on. And then there is Zombie Nightmare, because I know Cecil would want to talk about the Wrath with Charlie Sheen, but that doesn't count.
John Micklethor.
But John Micklethor and Adam West and Tia Carrere. But so we will pick up 1987 next week. For right now, where can people find the Cecil?
Find me at goodbadflix.com, as well as GoodBadFlix on YouTube, Twitch, Twitter, Facebook, and 1201beyond.com.
Where can people find the Great Monkey Man from the North?
Find me, of course, on Twitter at Cinematica, YouTube The Cinematicus, Facebook The Cinematicus, 1201beyond.com, and at Patreon at Cinematica.
You can find me at 1201beyond.com. Contact the show at 1201beyond@gmail.com. We will finish out the 80s next week. Keep one foot in the gutter, one fist in the gold. Have a good night. Ha, 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 ha.
subsequent to the events you have just witnessed. Similar events in cities across America. Events which bore a striking resemblance to the ones you have just seen begin occurring. Subsequent to the events you have just witnessed, unsuspecting jerks from Maine to California made the acquaintance of a new breed of flytrap and got sweet talked into feeding it blood. Thus the plans were fantastic.
Right. Radiodrome is a 1201 Beyond production. Find it and other great content at 1201beyond.com.